about. There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
All right, it is Nicole Sandler live at RadioOrNot.com. We are broadcasting live from Threshold Sound Studios in Santa Monica, and I'm so honored to be joined by Jackson Brown. Jackson, thank you so much for doing this today.
Oh, it's great to be here, Nicole. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. I know we've been talking about you coming on my show for a while now, and you were going to do it on Air America, and then, boy, the best laid plans, huh? Air America, almost exactly a month ago, filed Chapter 7 and just went under.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. So
you mean we're not on Air America?
We're not on Air America. I thought you knew that.
No, so I don't know anything. I've been buried in a studio. I've been working on a record for the last month, and I really have not paid much attention to anything going on in the world. You know,
so
really.
Tell us about the new record. What are you doing?
Well, actually, it's a record of a tour I did in Spain with David Lindley in 2006. So in a way, it's like being immersed in a time capsule, because really it was a pretty different world in 2006 than it is now. So that's 4 years ago, but it was really great. I would have released it at the time, but I started to make it into a very neat single album, and it just, our math was wrong. We got to the end and realized it was like 85 minutes long and we couldn't fit it in. And we started slashing and cutting. And after a day of trying to make it fit, I was so bummed. I just said, well, we're just going to have to put this out later and put everything back and make it a double album. So that's what we're doing. But it took till now. And actually, I wanted to release an album of my new songs before releasing this album anyway. Cause for David and I to get together, it's kind of a reunion for he and I, of sorts, you know. So we do a lot of older songs and some songs that, there's some newer songs that we haven't done together before. But, you know, it's like a vacation in a way. It's like, it's in Spain, which is one of my favorite places to go. But anyway, anytime you make a record, you know, it's really like you sort of barricade yourself in the studio and you don't really get a lot of news from the outside.
Right. So when is this record going to come out?
It'll come out in May.
Oh wow! And yeah. Then
in time for a tour that David's going to join me on in the summer. So I'm going to be touring together with him, and yeah, it's all part of just sort of. Matter of fact, I'm on my way to the Valley now to meet him and to work on some sound things, some ways of hearing, you know, and a way of fitting him into my band. I'm really excited because I think that Mark Goldenberg, who's the guitarist in my band for many years, and David, he and David don't do the same thing at all. Either of them can like do a little of what the other does, but it'll be really great to have two masters sort of, you know, like standing side by side playing.
Oh, how exciting. I mean, yeah. I think the last time I saw you with David Lindley must have been in 76?
We've toured periodically. We toured on and off, you know, like we always get together at some point or other. And, it may be years in between. And then anytime we do, we just sort of find our way back to that place. We have really a great chemistry. And so we'll play a lot of acoustic stuff but he'll also, you know, sort of bat and clean up when it comes to rocking, you know, because he hasn't been playing with loud bands a lot. And that's one of the things we're going to work on. How to make it so he can hear. And, his hearing's gotten kind of sensitive. So we're going to figure out how to make this work. I had a great time touring last summer. I just wanted to do it again just for fun, you know, just not even, not, I don't know. Then I thought of putting this record out as a way of celebrating he and I, you know, playing together again. I mean, anytime you do that, you're stuck in the studio. You tell me not only did I not know that Air America had gone under, but I've heard it from a couple people now, but I have not read anything or heard anything about these plants in Georgia and about Obama's decision to build no more nuclear plants.
Knowing that I was going to interview you today and thinking, okay, what are we going to be talking about? I open, I get these different news feeds, and there's this one, it's just story after story after story, that the first thing is that the Obama administration has guaranteed over $8 billion for construction of two new nuclear power plants in Georgia. And the Energy Secretary Chu, I believe is his name,
he's said,
we hope this is just the beginning of many more.
Yeah. Well, you know, they can say that, and they have to put a smiley face on just about anything they do. It's just part of what they have to do. But I got to say, what they're going to find out is that the plants come in way over budget, that they take too long to affect global warming at all. The plants won't be up for 10 years, you know, and then if they usually come in later than planned and for, you know, and they always come in for like 2 and 3 times what they're budgeted for. So if they're putting their toes in there for 8 billion to get their feet wet and figure out what it's like, yeah, they might say, yeah, we hope this is the beginning. You know, they can say they hope it's the beginning of something good because that phrase always accompanies everything that they do. And I could take it like a breach of faith. I actually asked Obama about his stance on nuclear because at one point I was a supporter of his right away, and then I switched because he did so badly in this face-off with John Edwards and Hillary Clinton, this debate. And, you know, he just made some very vague statements about, well, we're going to need some of that. Now, I interpreted it to be, well, yeah, we have some, so we're going to need to keep those. And I asked him about this, and he said, well, yeah, no, I'm not for any new plants. I'm not for building new plants.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could take that as a breach of a promise or a breach of faith. But what I think is happening is that with the global warming situation, there is this clamoring to do something and to do anything. And I think that, and also he's, you know, one of his main supporters in Illinois is, I think it's called Exelon. It's a company that not only owns nuclear power plants, but like every other kind of nuclear generating thing. And what I think is going to happen is that they're going to find that you know, they have made this concession to the nuclear industry, and they're going to find out that it doesn't work. They still haven't, no matter what they say, they haven't figured out what to do with the waste.
Right.
And he helped put, you know, like bury, like completely end the whole debacle about Yucca Mountain and building this facility in New Mexico, which would have housed nuclear waste, but it would have been filled the day that it opened.
Uh-huh. Right.
And you would have had these trucks carrying this waste all around the country to put it there. And it would have been, you know, and the problem is the waste, and they haven't solved the problem. And anytime someone says, well, I think we should have more, we can have more plants, we'll just have to figure out what to do with the waste. Well, welcome to a struggle that's been going on for 60 years. They have not figured out in 60 years what to do. They may say that they've made their plants safer and that they have a new model and it's the nuclear renaissance and all that. And that's just marketing. What they really mean is that they are still working on it, and they don't know what, you know, they don't know what they're going to do. What's even more amazing about this decision to give the nuclear industry like $8 billion sort of free pass, they haven't figured out in 50 years how to make it profitable for themselves given the risks.
Right. Nobody will insure them.
Nobody will
guarantee the money. So that's why
no one will deal with the cost overruns and the safety problems. And then on top of that, they're a huge risk to terrorism. You know,
and we haven't even addressed the water issue. We are coming up to a point in history where the next war might be fought over water, and it takes a crazy
amount
of water.
That is what the war in the Middle East is about. Is what Israel is all about. It's about the water.
The water. Okay. Everyone thinks it's oil, but the water is becoming more and more scarce, and it takes crazy amounts of water to cool down
the core. The settlers aren't going
into
Palestine for oil.
No, because that's where they get the water.
They're going to expand. They're expanding, and it's all about water rights. And that's what the problem is with.
And that's one of the big problems with building new nuclear reactors is the water it takes to cool it down, to keep it cool.
And it's not a solution for global warming because actually plants produce heat. I mean, they heat the rivers. So there are a lot of rivers in Louisiana that are being heated to 95 degrees, and the fish are dying. They can't live just because of the heat.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the problems of leaking and storage. And, you know, I mean, the most sophisticated plans that they have for storing the waste amount to burying it, and they even in cement canisters, those don't last long. There's no testing to prove how long that will last. They've tried a lot of different things, and when it leaks, it produces, you know, it's dangerous for human health, but also it's dangerous for 280,000 years. It has the waste has a half-life of 280,000 years. So it's so arrogant and so egotistical for us as a culture to think that like we're going to like fix this in a few years. And like, if they really had a scientific I mean, no scientist will say, yeah, we have a solution.
Right. Well, and I think as you said, because they have to do something about climate change, and cap and trade is not ever going to pass. So this is their fallback solution. Now, Jackson Brown is with us. You go back over 30 years with the No Nukes movement. You were one of the founding members of MUSE, Musicians United for Safe Energy. You did the very famous No Nukes concerts at Madison Square Garden. And then it was just a couple of years ago that you and Bonnie Raitt and Graham Nash, Keb Moe, and Ben Harper got together and started up a new website, nukefree.org, and you guys actually went to D.C. and got something like this stopped, at least temporarily.
There was language. It was really kind of a Paul Revere's Midnight Ride kind of effort to stop a bill from passing, which was supposed to be a clean energy bill, and it had somehow picked up some language in it that basically gave the nuclear industry $50 billion worth of loan guarantees. And nobody knew it was there, including, I mean, there are a lot of people who had fought long and hard for this bill because it was for clean energy, and it would have, and so that the nuclear industry was trying to call it nuclear clean energy is not surprising, but that these people didn't even know that the language was in there. One senator said, turned to her aide and said, "Where did that come from? Where did that?" And then he came back immediately. "We think that got inserted in Ways and Means or something." It goes from committee to committee, and stuff happens to it.
Right.
So by the time that it was about to pass, it had like picked up this language, and it wouldn't have been discovered at all if some. It was a very tricky thing because it really referred to an earlier bill that was passed. It was language that referred to another bill which nobody knew about when that bill was, you know, the thing that gave away the farm. You know, so. Two reporters from the New York Times wrote about it, and suddenly everybody was who wouldn't have noticed it at all, especially and even in the No Nukes movement said, "Oh, we got to do something." So we tried to sort of sound the alarm, but you can't. It's a 30-year-old emergency, you know. And you can't really sustain that feeling of like, "Oh, I got to do something." And I know people who are doing that, who are working, you know, day after day in this. In the movement for safe energy and to find alternatives, and you got to pace yourself. You got to like really decide. I mean, in my case, okay, I did those concerts, and we were aiding a movement that was very broad based movement, grassroots movement, and between the time we planned the No Nukes concerts in Madison Square Garden and we did them, Three Mile Island happened. So in a way, we didn't need to really explain it to very many people. They knew about it by the time the concerts happened, and we were part of a movement, part of a way. We didn't initiate anything. And then you also had the movie China Syndrome, which was a very, very big movie. That came out. And so, you know, but, you know, over the course of time, the nuclear industry has portrayed Three Mile Island as a place where nobody was injured, there were no deaths.
Which is all nonsense.
Which is not true at all. And I know a man who was a reporter on the scene at the time and interviewed all kinds of people with health problems. What that means is that they're able to call it something else. Over time, they're able to deny that there were, I mean, you get the same people denying that Chernobyl was a problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really, you know, it's really up to all of us to really pay attention to the actual survivor stories of the on the site stuff and pay attention to the statistics, you know, about really who has gotten sick and who has how the rise in fatalities and health problems in these areas
and cancer.
And we're in the middle of an epidemic of cancer. I mean, people are trying to figure out where it's coming from. You know, but one thing certain is radiation produces cancer.
That's right.
But you know what else produces health problems in humans is bisphenol A, which is what they use to make plastic bottles. And who doesn't drink out of plastic bottles?
That's right. And I noticed at
your
show.
It also is used to line the inside of tin cans.
Wow.
And so we're taking in small amounts of bisphenol A, BPA, and there are studies in England now that show that this actually influences developing humans, and it actually changes the hormonal growth in babies, and so that the babies are measurably less masculine. Male babies have less masculine hormones and more feminine hormones in their balance, you know. And these studies are just coming out now, and so there's a huge. Still, you have a plastic industry which uses bisphenol A to make everything that they make, and they of course have. And they're a multi-billion-dollar industry that uses their resources to try to spin that and try to their issue disclaimers saying, well, the results are not in and we're not really sure about it. We're not so sure. I say that the most ethical and most honest and the most forward looking of those companies are working on ways to make their product without the toxic chemicals.
Right. Now I noticed, and you were on tour a few months ago doing a solo acoustic tour. You came to Miami and you were the water bottles.
I'm selling these bottles made out of, they're made out of stainless steel and they're made in China. You know, it's not a perfect solution. I mean, apparently to make stainless steel.
No, they don't
make them here.
And unbelievable. And, we don't make anything here.
But also, apparently there are some drawbacks to in the process. But the difference is that if you have a metal bottle, and if I had a metal bottle with a picture of Jimi Hendrix on it or Ben Harper or, you know, or anybody, you know, Wilco or something. Matter of fact, Wilco does put out a bottle that also, there's a company called Green Bottle that puts out bottles with the names of your favorite bands and stuff.
Right.
And it's not only do they, but those bottles are produced in China. But the real benefit is that you can use that bottle over and over and over again. And I've got I keep leaving them. In the last month, I've lost three or four of my favorite bottles. And I left in places because I forget, you know.
Right.
But really, get another one. The price is that instead of, you know, you go without drinking water, or you know what? Go to the drinking fountain.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, and those have disappeared. I mean,
and make your community put the drinking fountains back in, and get involved in the over. I mean, the truth is that there are more safety, there's more oversight, and more attention being paid to the quality of the water in the communities than there is in these companies. And even if you buy a bottle, a plastic bottle that has a picture of a mountain range on it, if you look on the label, it'll say, New Jersey or Connecticut, and they're not coming from a mountain range someplace. It's coming from a municipal water supply, and they're charging you 200 times what they paid for the water. And they're polluting it with a pollutant, and it's all for your convenience. It's also that you can have this water whenever you want. But dig it. You take a sip of that water, you sit it down, and everybody else in the room has got their bottle of water, and then you can't figure out which one was yours,
right.
So you open a new one.
Yes. And it's always...
We were using a 6-foot-high pallet of water at every gig.
Wow.
And we decided to start carrying our own water and filtering it ourselves. And we have, like, our refrigerator on our bus is filled with Brita filters, you know, filters.
Sure.
And... you know, other than that, it's tap water. I mean, I order tap water every restaurant I go to because why should you buy, even if it comes in glass, which would be good, better than plastic, it's usually been flown someplace and using petrol miles to fly that stuff there. I mean, it's just all marketing. We're just objects. And it's not, if it's for a convenience, I'll ask you this. What is so convenient about developing a life-threatening illness halfway through your life because of something you've consumed in micro amounts your entire life? And when they find it so mysterious that everybody's getting cancer, and there's studies that show it might be this and it might be that. But there are certain things that really for sure are bad for you.
And we know the plastic in those plastic bottles.
We know that bisphenol A is one of them.
Yeah. You know, you also have to wonder about what is causing this epidemic of autism in children. Now, they're saying that it's not from the vaccines. That's been disproven. But then
I don't
there's
think that.
Something.
No, I don't believe that. I don't believe it's been disproven. For one thing, the problem with the mercury in the vaccine was a commerce issue. It was because it wasn't that
it was a preservative.
It was a preservative,
yes.
So that they could use a larger bottle,
and
it would be kept on their shelf longer,
right,
instead of a smaller bottle. And they would amount of mercury that was in there, they were to shoot into a little baby's
veins,
blood.
Right.
They know that it's toxic. They know it's a hazardous amount to expose a child to that much mercury. And if you've heard that it's been disproven, then I really have to see who's saying
well,
that.
Well, this has just
so
been,
many of these
again,
studies are done by the,
last... the
actual pharmaceutical companies.
Yes.
I mean, that's another thing that's happened to our society is that all these, the actual agencies that we use to patrol the companies are relying on information given to them by the companies. This happened with the cell phones. All the studies being cited were actually paid for by the cell phone companies.
Yeah.
No, I think that people have to really look beyond this. Obviously, it's legal to lie about your product in this country.
Yeah.
It's
well,
legal
and now
to,
it's going to get worse. I mean, the Supreme Court ruled that in this case, Citizens United versus the Federal Elections Commission, basically they took away all the restrictions on how much money corporations yeah. can contribute to political campaigns.
Yeah.
So if we were, you know, it just opened the floodgates. And yeah. you hear the Republicans talking about they don't want any activist judges on the bench. Well, we have an activist Supreme Court who wants to turn this into a corporatocracy if we're not already there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm wondering now, like, what the difference is between being a pessimist and a fatalist. Because I don't like the idea of being a pessimist, you know?
Right.
And in the words of the great poet Carolyn Forché, you know, it is not your right to feel hopeless. No, helpless. It's not your right to feel helpless. Better people than you are helpless. You know? Like, buck up. Do something in your defense. Defend the planet. I just saw the two most beautiful children waiting next to their dad in line to be seated in this restaurant I was sitting in. And they were just the two little girls and little sisters, the older sister and little baby sister. And yeah, they're like little flowers. They're so beautiful. I thought, you know, if not for... You, when you talk about the safety of the planet or the health of, you know, of people in general, go look into the eyes of a newly developing, mm-hmm. a small child, you know, and your own children, or if you don't have any children, somebody else's children. But check it out. We're only here for a little while. Mm-hmm. We owe it to those creatures, those beautiful newcomers, you know, to leave them something that's inhabitable and that doesn't leave them with serious, you know, debilitating injuries, you know, like right, you know, as they're getting off the blocks.
Right. And that's the sad thing. It seems like our government now is siding with the corporations against the best interests of the people, wherein we're helpless to do anything about it. The election
Obama
of Barack
Obama, fundraised Bush, you know, by a great deal in that
election.
Well,
and a lot
not
of that
Bush,
money.
Not Bush, but McCain. I mean, but the Republicans.
Right.
You know,
money came from corporations too, and that's the problem. I mean, I thought when Obama was elected, all right, things are going to change for the better, but we're seeing a lot more of the same. So where do we go?
Well, the
from
Democrats
here?
Have that chronic thing where they don't have to listen to progressive voices because we're all you've got.
Right.
You've got to go along with us.
The progressives are always going to go along.
Who are you
going
to go?
Right.
Are you going to cross the street and go to a competitor? Who are you going to vote for, McCain? No, I'm all you've got. So, you know, just pipe down, and you might make some concessions towards what you believe. But it's foolish, you know. I mean, I knew when he appointed the
Rahm Emanuel.
No, the science his science guy. Chu, is it?
Yeah, it's energy. Yep.
That he's really letting he's opening the floodgates
and
there.
And
but
wait,
what they're going to find out? Look, here's what's going to happen with the nukes. And I'll say it again: they're going to find out. It's not going to solve any of the problems. All it's going to do is like allow that industry to reestablish a kind of foothold mm-hmm. and to continue. They're going to pass the over cost overruns to the American taxpayer. He's adding more in a kind of like that's socialism actually when you allow, you know, the federal government to be the one left holding the bag and they pay for this. It's not real socialism. Why don't they just do it themselves? What they said originally when they opened these plants in the 50s to these utilities, said, look, either you go into the nuclear industry, into nuclear power, or we will, and you'll be competing with this, and they all went, okay, well, we'll do it, you know. So now you got as a private industry, an industry that is trying to make a profit, but Wall Street won't invest in it unless they're indemnified, unless
right.
they're told that if there's an accident, if there's a cost overrun, if there's a class action suit, you won't have to pay anything.
Right, because no one will insure them.
But why should we make that somebody's profit-making business if we're going to have to pay the cost over? And that is a ridiculous state of affairs.
Yes.
It's kind of like corporate socialism.
It is. Know? It's exactly corporate socialism. And if we're going to have socialism, why don't they help the people, you know, rather than the corporations? Yeah. I mean, you know, we can go on and talk about healthcare too. It's the same kind of thing.
Well, there are countries that do have socialized medicine, yeah. have socialized programs that are not socialist countries, like mm-hmm. Norway, not a socialist country, but they have socialized programs. They take look after the people. And they also have like a ton of oil, and they've got a bunch of, they lead the world in technology for alternative energy uses and ways of generating energy. You know, I don't know. Maybe it's the residual patriotism of a life lived, you know, like, you know, in the United States. But really, I kind of think that my country has a leading role to play. I really think the United States could be leaders in all, in these alternative, you know, in improving these technologies at work. When we did the No Nukes, I mean, one thing I realized, like, recording studios use a lot of electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I did was I went off the grid in the place that I, it's not where I live all the time, but it's my ranch. But I actually can live there. I mean, it actually, the electricity doesn't go off more than about, you know, like, it went off the day because everybody in the house was like, had every light in the house on, and then suddenly somebody turned on the hairdryer and we had to go turn on the generator and put it back on. Everything, you go around turning off the lights and you have to be aware of what you consume. But I mean, the next thing I'm going to do is go off grid in the city, because people just assume that, well, that's one thing doing it out in the country, and, oh yeah, you don't live there all the time. But I did that because I thought, well, if I'm proposing that people really conserve, you know, we said at the time, conservation would be a tremendous source of energy. If you cut down on what you're using, call that an energy source. Amory Lovin said that. Amory Lovin advises, you know, Exxon and these huge, you know, and all these huge oil companies about how to conserve energy. And he could call, you know, conservation an actual energy source. And we could lead the world in that too. Because we have the ingenuity, and we have I think people have the will if they can get beyond the actual out and out lying that is going on, you know, in the marketplace. I mean, people should be held to their promises, you know. I mean, this is just such like another in a list of, you know, mistakes that the Obama has made. But it's, in my opinion, staying in Afghanistan is a gigantic mistake, and he said it all along, that's what he was going to do.
Yes. So
we had no choice. We had to vote for Obama because the alternative was somebody who was going to, you know, like...
Bomb Iran. Right.
Yeah, exactly. So...
But what do we do now?
I think that we have to look to ourselves once again, the question of convenience comes up. I mean, I'm guilty of this too. Like, as soon as Obama was elected, I thought, okay, well, yeah, that's settled, you know, and I can go back to work, you know,
things
and
are
go
get
back
better
and
now.
Like,
okay.
And every time you look up, you know, things are more and more complex and more difficult, and there's so many things going wrong. But I really do think that, you know, our country is not taking care of its vets. It's continuing to sort of base its economy on a certain amount of warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And these are things that we have to look to ourselves to answer. I mean, I'm not sure how to. I haven't ever summoned the courage to be a member of a tax revolt, say, or simply say, I'm not paying for this. And I sort of guard against anything that would like really derail me from my work, my calling, the thing that I love to do. And I suppose, when it comes down to it, yeah, I have to like hold myself responsible if I'm a resident of a country that is, you know, if I mean, you can do everything you can to try to ameliorate the problems and to try to reduce them and try to answer them. And I really think that small things matter, small things work, like not, you know, using plastic bottles and, you know, going to the trouble of filling up your metal bottle and carrying it with you, that kind of thing will help. Or just the thing that they tried to ridicule Obama for, you know, like keeping your tires filled and making sure that you get as good a mileage as you can.
Right.
You know, like getting, I'm going to get rid of my hybrid as soon as I can get an all-electric car. And I'm going to put the photovoltaic cells on top of the studio in L.A. And I'm going to try to do that on the house, my house in L.A. too, and try to demonstrate that stuff really does work. Because people, there's a lot of sort of mythology that, oh, it's too expensive, you can't really do it. Really, you save a lot of money right away. All those things matter, but I'm not sure what any of it matters if you're downwind from a nuclear reactor when it's bombed, you know, or when. You know, they simply shouldn't have them. We should not be sitting living among these terrorist targets, which, if bombed, will contaminate. I mean, if the World Trade Center attackers had dropped their load or flown into Indian Point reactor in Long Island,
yes,
and they flew right over it,
yeah,
if they had decided to put it into there, they'd still be cleaning that up, and the effects
and
of,
Long Island
of,
would be
and
gone.
Long Island would be, and it would have been many, many, many times greater catastrophe and over a longer period of time.
So, you've always, but when you started.
Right, what I was going to say was something really kind of fatalistic, and I really, which is, I don't know what you can do everything you can, and then you have to do your best to enjoy life and try to, and know that some of these decisions are very momentous for all time. You know, I mean, you have to really kind of hold the line there. But in the end, you know, the biggest questions are, hey, does democracy really work? And there's a good chance that it doesn't work.
Uh-huh.
And it's just an excuse for us, like, dominating the world militarily because we want them to have democracy. But really, we don't practice democracy all that well ourselves, you know, and so, you know, I love that Leonard Cohen song, Democracy is Coming to the USA, because it's such an optimistic song.
Uh-huh.
I like that. Doesn't it sound good? Hope it
happens one day. Jackson Brown, your music, when you first started recording, a lot of it was, you know, some of your songs are so sad. They were heartache. They were romance. They were life. And then you sort of took a turn and you got very political. Your activism came through in your music. The new music you're writing, the new stuff you're coming out with, where does that fall?
Well, the last record I made was a sort of return to some of those more, well, it had a couple of out and out political diatribes in it, but the rest, most of the songs were more about, relationships and about, just this point in my life, and looking back at there's some questions. I mean, I'd say they have this one song that's really sort of about my generation and about the idea of free love, you know. And how it sort of combines with materialism, you know, how, you know, and I like playing with language. So the new songs, I tell you, I probably go back into writing a bunch of really sort of out and out political songs at this point. There's some waiting in the wings that I just, you know, I can always write a song, decrying the losses our country is suffering in terms of war, or just, I've got a song title called Death by Envy, which is really about our celebrity society, you know, celebrity worshiping. And, but I, to me, when the love songs come up, you know, you gotta write them. You have to they come in handy too. You know, there's nothing like singing a song to, I've been sitting in clubs a lot recently. Like, friends of mine will say, well, I'm playing over here. Would you want to come by and I'll get to go sit in with a band that hasn't ever really played, and we'll play, you know, a fairly simple song or a song that not everybody knows. And it's really that's where the song really does its work, you know? People are really listening.
Mm-hmm.
In the band, they're really listening. You're not performing something you've rehearsed. And the song inhabits the room. And takes everybody, or doesn't. I mean, if you can capture a room like that, it's pretty much a thrill for me. I mean, when you do a concert, you know, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. They did buy a ticket to come see you,
uh-huh.
and they do know the songs already.
Right.
And so it's really a lot of fun to do that. But it's more exciting really to play for people that really don't know quite who you are. I think I've heard some of your songs.
Uh-huh.
You know? So I've been doing that. I did that last night. I did that last couple of weeks. And when I do that with my band, there's a gig that my band does. Members of my band play. And it's kind of one of the names it's given is the Song and Dance Society. And we used to do it in a bar. Now they're doing this really great listening room. And all these great musicians have been coming by and playing. And the musicianship is really high. And you get people coming. It's a kind of like a reunion, you know, which we had to do anyway to figure out how to get together without it being a funeral, because there's more and more of those, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I'm 60 now.
Wow.
And,
you look amazing.
Or 61. 60. I'm not sure. But I say that because for a long time I thought I was about a year, I thought I was a year older than I really was. And anyway, the function of writing a song for me is kind of like staring into a crystal ball. I mean, you really have to try to make something materialize out of this dark spot in the middle where you pull things from, and whether it's from your and generally it involves really kind of I've always, even if I've sung a really sad song or a song that was expressed doubts of all kinds, you know, I try to summon some kind of optimism. That's why I was saying, I don't think I can call myself an optimist anymore, but I do, you know. I don't like to be a pessimist. I don't want to be, you know. Can you be an optimist and a fatalist? I'm trying to figure out how to put these together. I think you can.
Well, you can look for the silver lining out there somewhere, right? You know, there's got to be a bright side to there's got to be some good point. I mean,
you know, music has this wonderful capacity to energize people and to give them hope and to give them and give them solace. So that's what I use it for. I actually never thought that it worked unless you were willing to first express a certain amount of doubt, you know, if in the course of, you know, I mean, otherwise it sounds too evangelical, you know.
Well, you know, we can talk about Bruce Springsteen, who I know is a good friend of yours. I've seen you jump on stage with Bruce, or he on stage with you before. And he did with The Rising and with Magic. I mean, he took, Magic was a pretty brutal anti-war record, but he did it with some hope there. He took The Rising after 9/11 and came up with something hopeful. So there is a way to balance that.
Yeah, he's really great. He has the depth and the can write on that scale, you know, to address those things.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the way I look at music is even music which seems entirely personal, like say blues, you know, is also political. If it's sung by, you know, and it was sung by people who were subjugated people. I mean, you know, sung by slaves and former slaves, you know, form for talking about what life is really like. It's truth telling. So at times it is very political.
Do we need the protest song to come back again?
I think that has never left. I think that people have always, you know, sung songs in which they, like, look at that great song, Pink. Dear Mr. President.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Is that a protest song? I don't know. I don't think anybody that sings music like that worries about that kind of a label. But I think it's for an industry that is almost trained from the 30s onward. You know, the music industry and the film industry was like sort of trained to avoid carrying any kind of political messages. Sammy Lowen said, if you got a message, try Western Union. You know, he didn't really like to, but I think some of our great films, you know, and the ones that portray humanity to its fullest are films that have a point of view, you know, and, I think to hide behind the supposed mantle of, you know, the supposed value of objectivity is it's a little bit chicken, you know. It's a little bit cowardly. And I do think that many of our newscasters, you know, could stand like a good healthy dose of subjectivity. That's why I like Keith Olbermann
and Rachel Maddow.
Yep. Fantastic. Really good that they came along, because, you know, it was a pretty one-sided feel for a while.
And the same goes with talk radio. I mean, and back full circle, there are 9 hours of conservative talk to every 1 hour of progressive talk on the airwaves. And now with the loss of Air America, which happened less than a month ago, there's a whole lot of voices have been silenced. So, like, for me, you know, I moved the show online and working at other ways to try to get my show back on the air but keep the online thing going, because this is where everything is moving. It goes back to corporate control of everything in this country. The big, you know,
I think the best radio in we have in the country is, listener subscriber radio. I think that KPFK and, I think that KCRW, I think that the PBS, the public radio is to a lesser extent free of corporate sponsorship, but I do think that those are the stations where people like who have worked at Air America and who are, I mean, will find a, you know, hope that, well, I don't know if that
there
I,
and
I guess
online.
What I'm trying to say is I think that the listenership for those people is still there, whether they have a corporate structure or not.
And I think more and more people are seeking us out online. And there's Tom Hartman, and there's, you know, he does his own show. He syndicates it himself. There's Stephanie Miller and Randy Rhodes.
Right.
And, you know, they still have their shows. It's Air America, the network that went down.
Right.
And it was mostly not because of their political stance, but because of mismanagement, and the company was run poorly. Mm. But it's just the fact that the big companies put the Rush Limbaughs, the conservative talk stations, on the stations with the big signals. And if they have another secondary signal Channel in the market, another AM. They'll maybe put the progressive talk on there because the companies.
Well, there are more blowhards than there are thinkers in our country.
Yeah, and that's the problem. But we still have to work with, you know, on getting our voices out there.
Yeah.
So, Jackson, I know you were going to come by here for a half hour, and I could talk to you forever, but I know you've
well,
got
I
to
leave
get up
you and... to go get together with David Lindley and check out some sound equipment. And
how awesome.
Thanks for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to get to talk to you. Nice
Thank
to
you
see you
so
in California.
Much. Yes, and it's great to be here. I'm heading
do you
down.
Do you miss California?
I do. I love it here. Heading down to San Diego tomorrow for this music conference, which, by the way, I'm told to extend an invitation for you if you'd like to come.
Oh.
It's adventurous radio programmers and music supervisors.
I would love
and
to, but I'm going to Japan tomorrow.
Oh, tomorrow. Yeah. You're doing a tour with Sheryl Crow,
yeah, I'm doing
you?
A tour in Japan with Sheryl Crow. When we come back, we're getting ready to go on tour here in the United States with David Lindley. So.
Oh, great. Well, I will...
I will think of you as I'm... eating all kinds of interesting things in Japan.
Well,
and have a good time in San Diego.
Definitely. Say hello to Sheryl Crow for
all
me.
Right,
we go way, way back. And why don't we play, how about Time the Conqueror?
Okay.
We'll play from Jackson
thank
Brown.
You.
And thank you so much for joining
Thanks
us
for
on Radio
on
or
show.
Not. All right. Hit it.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Susan Brown. Time the Conqueror.